Hello, everyone, and welcome to the next episode of the Disclosure Podcast. I am your host, Ed, and I hope you're all doing well, and I hope you're all still safe and looking after yourselves, and I hope that you're doing good wherever you are in the world, and whatever situation the country you live in might well be. And so today's episode is going to be addressing a few questions that I get asked pretty much on an everyday basis. I always get asked questions about pets. What should I feed my pets? You know, am I still vegan if I have a cat who eats meat and all this kind of, well, it's a bit of a minefield, isn't it? And so I thought I'd do a podcast kind of going through it, talking broadly about cats and dogs, and then maybe more, a little bit more in depth, I suppose, about the pet industry as a whole and the adopt, don't shop philosophy. And I guess what that means long term for having pets if we, you know, live by this philosophy. Before we get into the podcast, I just want to start by saying a big thank you to all my patrons. If you guys are listening, thank you so much for all of your support. Patreon is a service where people can support the work that I do. And through doing so, they get access to a Discord server. So Discord's like a WhatsApp, I suppose. It's like a messaging service, but there's different channels within the server. We talk about different topics, philosophy, films, TV, you know, books. We have like a general chat where we go through a lot of different things related to veganism, and we have like a cooking channel. So we have a variety of different conversations going on in there. And also every month I do a patron Q&A podcast where my patrons ask me questions and I go through as many of the questions as I can and give responses to them. And so I think we've addressed pets before in one of those patron ones, but probably not for as long as I will be doing so in today's podcast. So let's get into it, because there is quite a few different parts of it to discuss, a few different areas that we can go through, a few different ideas, I suppose. It's a complicated one in many ways, and I suppose it's also not that complicated in many ways as well. One of the things I'm going to just reference right now at the beginning is a lot of the information I'm getting in terms of just like a brief overview comes from a website called Veggie Pets, which is spelled V-E-G-E Pets. And so it has information about cats and dogs mainly, I think, and kind of like what a vegan diet for these animals would look like, and I suppose the considerations you should take. So if you are a human to a cat or a dog, don't want to use the word owner. This is another thing about pets, isn't it, that we can maybe talk about? Well, we talk about it now. One of the kind of brief overview points about pets is how we talk about them. I think as humans, we generally believe that we have this dominion over animals, and in many ways, a pet is almost the quintessential example of that dominion. You know, we call ourselves owners. I own, you know, I am a dog owner, I am a cat owner. It doesn't mean that we don't love these animals, but it's just interesting how we use this terminology to talk about the animals that we love within our homes. We don't say, oh, I'm a baby owner. Yes, I am a child owner. Here we go, oh, I have a child. Yeah, I'm a parent. But when it comes to animals that we have in our home, companion animals, it's like, yeah, no, I'm a dog owner. It's just interesting. And I think that comes down to the idea of purchasing. And I suppose the adopt, don't shop philosophy, when you're rescuing an animal, it makes that relationship a lot more symbiotic straight away. You know, you recognize, oh, you know, I'd like to have an animal in my home, a companion animal, but I don't think it's right to buy an animal, you know, and exchange money for a life, especially when there's so many animals in shelters who need rescuing. So I go to a shelter to rescue an animal, and it is this kind of symbiotic thing. You know, I'm saving this animal's life. I'm giving them the home they should deserve and the life they deserve. And as a consequence to that, I'm getting the reward of having a dog or a cat or a rabbit or a gerbil or a hamster in my home to give me, you know, company and to give me happiness and joy and all these different things that we can mutually bring to that dynamic, you know, when we have pets and humans. So interesting. Anyway, a little bit off tangent there. So let's kind of dive into it a little bit more. The thing I was really alluding to when I was talking about the Veggie Pets website was really to say there's a bit of information on there about considerations if you are putting a dog or a cat on a vegan diet. And so I think it's really important that whatever I say in this podcast, you know, I don't have a dog or a cat, you know, I'm not looking after one of these animals. So I think it's really important that before you make any decisions, just go and have a look through this website, V-E-G-E Pets, Veggie Pets, .info/index. So I think it's .com. And just read through it yourself, because it's always important to know what you want to do and what you think is right. And what I'm talking about now isn't to tell someone how they should, you know, feed their pets necessarily, but it's maybe just to prompt a few ideas around it and maybe talk just a little bit about the strange reasons that we have to give the dogs and cats the food that we do and how actually it doesn't make sense. It's a little bit contradictory, but we'll get into that. Let's start off a little bit broader and let's just talk more simply about the logistics of dogs and cats, and then we'll talk a bit more in detail about some of the unnatural things that we do with them. So with dogs, one thing that I think is quite interesting to note is that cancer is actually the number one disease-related killer of dogs, and it claims millions of pets each year, of course, cancer. One in four dogs, apparently, will develop cancer in their lifetime, which is kind of a horrifying thing. The cancer, of course, it could be many cancers, but I know that one of them is colon cancer. And it always seems strange to me that an animal, you know, who is, we would say, more designed to eat meat, I mean, they're omnivores, aren't they, dogs? So they can digest these products and, of course, can live on them. And you'd think it would be strange, therefore, that they would end up in a situation where they're getting colon cancer or cancers in general from the food that they eat. Obviously, it's not just about food, but as we know, food is one of the biggest contributors, if not maybe the biggest lifestyle contributor to what happens in later life with chronic illness and chronic disease and cancer being, you know, a big part of that. So before we go into that, just a little bit of an overview, a little bit of an introduction, which is that obviously when we're talking about food, I think what we don't realize is that the food that we give to our pets, you know, is highly, highly processed foods. In the US in the early 2000s, we spent about $6 billion a year on dog food. And I think it's about $5 billion on cat food, which is a lot of money to spend, right, on this industry. There's a lot of money to put into killing animals. Now, because it's such a highly processed product, it is what we classify as being a byproduct. And one note that I've got wrote down to talk about later is that idea of the byproduct and what that means, and does that make it more ethical, and how does that look? But I think before we get into that, I just want to talk about what that processed food looks like. Like, what is that? So just reading from it here. So one of the reasons that we buy these products for our pets is because we're sold this idea that it's high quality, that it's good for them, that it's nutritious. We see these adverts that kind of glorify that idea, not glorify, but perpetuate that idea, these adverts that really reinforce the notion that this pet food is really good for them, it's nutritious, it's natural, it's what they should be eating. And so it's quite obvious that when we buy into that, we think that we're buying what our pet should be consuming, what our dogs and what our cats should be consuming. What we don't know or what we don't think about is how actually that's obviously not the case. We're not feeding our pets the animal products that we consume. I mean, we eat cancerous, you know, very terrible animal products, right? Like even like the best cuts, as I say, quote unquote, best cuts are still horrendous and still go through a huge process that involves all these nasty things like the organs and all the blood and the tendons and the ligaments and all the butchering, the mutilation and the killing, and all, of course, the farming with the antibiotics and the hormones and the feed and the grain and all these things and the confinement and the exploitation, all of this. And we eat that stuff. And then, of course, there's the other stuff, like the stuff that's not even fit for human consumption. And when you look at the world and we think about Monsanto and we think about the GM, you know, the pesticides and the herbicides and the fertilizers, and we think about all the things that are kind of quote unquote fit for human consumption, right? And just how terrible those things are. And then our pets are fed the food, I say food very loosely, of course, the products that are not even fit for human consumption. Now that is really going to tell us a lot about what we're feeding these animals. So of course, we're looking at, you know, ground up heads, feet, intestines, brains, tongues, the esophagus. So basically all the insides that we wouldn't eat. So, you know, not the kidneys and livers, all these other nasty bits we wouldn't eat. And of course, cancerous tissue as well. I think we've seen those images, or if we haven't, there are images that go around of meat that has cancer on it, and that gets into the human supply chain. Of course, you know, it's not technically supposed to, but it does. But with pet food, it just goes, everything goes in there. One thing I found quite alarming, I think, when I was reading about this is to do with euthanasia. And I read maybe 2 years ago now, that they'd done a study, or not a study, but they tested random samples of pet foods. And when they were testing the pet foods, they found traces of dog and cat meat in the pet food. And so what that meant was that, I mean, this is just absolutely horrendous, isn't it? What it meant was that shelter animals were being used as pet food. So when they were killed in the shelters, they were then macerated and sold into the pet industry and used in pet food, and then mixed up with the chicken heads and the cow brains and the turkey intestines and all these other bits, just ground up, mixed together, and then they use like flavoring as an enhancements to make it more palatable. And of course, the gravies and all of this. One of the things they call the meat is 4D meat. Now, what that means is that the 4Ds are dead, dying, diseased, or disabled. And so animals who go into a slaughterhouse who are either dead, who are dying, and not by the hands of the slaughterman, but just dying, diseased, or disabled, they would be not fit for human consumption, and so would then be ground up to be used for pet food consumption. They call this meat meal and byproducts, and about 50% or so of commercial brands use meat meal, which is just meal, right? It's just ground up anything that they can get hold of. So yeah, we've got rendered dogs and cats from animal shelters being ground up and fed to the dogs and cats that we love. I used to say that, you know, we were a nation of dog and cat lovers, and not just in the UK, but probably Europe and America, most of the world in general. And even in places in the world where people consume dogs, you can still have dogs and cats as pets. Kind of like of us and rabbits, I suppose. You know, we have rabbits as pets, we have rabbits as children's toys, but we also wear rabbits and test on rabbits and eat rabbits and hunt rabbits and do terrible things to rabbits. It's just so bewildering to me. But I always used to say, you know, we're a nation of dog and cat lovers. We would never allow these things to happen to our dogs and cats. But then I was reading about how, you know, we used to breed dogs and cats. We still do, of course, but there's huge breeding facilities that would breed dogs and cats for animal testing. And of course, the puppy mills. And now, add on top of that, the fact that we knowingly grind up these animals who have been put down. Maybe they're, you know, abandoned animals in shelters. Maybe they were stray animals who are caught on the street and not adopted, or were never even put up for adoption, were just euthanized, and then that's it, into pet foods that someone else's dog or cat will eat them. I mean, it's just, it's really worrying to me, like really worrying. Other things that you find in pet foods are PCBs, contaminants and chemicals, so heavy metals, toxins. Obviously, when we feed fish to our pets, full of like mercury and different things like that. But then you've got bacterias and fungals and what we call, I think this is pronounced prions, contaminants. I think that's how you pronounce it. Now, prions, that's what BSE is. So there's different types of disease, infectious disease and disease, right? So you've got the coronaviruses and the influenzas and such. BSE was a prion, and I think it's called prion. It's either prion or prion. And that's what BSE was. And BSE was caused by, you know, cannibalizing, forcing animals to cannibalize on one another. The sheep were cannibalizing on sheep, but also cattle cannibalizing on cattle. And so in a way, that's what we're doing with our pets when we're buying commercial pet food, or what we could be doing. Not to say that every, you know, pet food that we buy has this problem in it, but of course we can't prove that it doesn't, and there's many places where it probably does. And so the thing that caused something like BSE was forcing animals to cannibalize, but then we do that with our pets. That to me is astounding and so, so worrying. And of course, then you've got the hormones, the antibiotic residues, the preservatives, all of these different things. And then it starts to make sense, doesn't it? That, well, actually, the number one killer of dogs is cancer. One in four dogs will get cancer. I think one in five cats gets cancer. And it starts to make sense all of a sudden, because we say, well, dogs are omnivores, they're meant to eat this way. And then all of a sudden they're eating these products that we're talking about now, the 4Ds, dead, dying, diseased, or disabled, then all the organs, the intestines, and the esophagus. I was reading that with the ear tags, everything just gets ground up in these big grinders. And then that's what's put in pet food. So even like plastic, you know, from the ear tags and whatever else there is, the cancerous tissue, whatever else there is, just ground up. And then here's the irony of it all, is that these products that we give to our pets are supplemented with the vitamins, the minerals, the nutrients that they need. People say, well, vegan food is not natural. And it's like, okay, well, let's give our pets, you know, ground up chicken's heads and esophagus and intestines and cancerous tissue, and ground up other animals of their same species. And then let's put the nutrients they need into that. And then what's worse? What's worse? The vegan pet food that's, you know, based on whole foods, you know, sweet potatoes, vegetables, there's maybe supplemented with some bits, you know, that they just to give them that boost that they need, the vitamin D, B12, whatever it might be. Or the same thing, the supplements of the vitamins they need and the nutrients they need, but the 4Ds of meat, dead, dying, diseased, disabled as well. I mean, just terrible to think. Dead, dying, diseased, disabled, grind them up, give them to pets, supplement the pet food, and then say that's the natural one, and then say the vegan food isn't right. I think it's important to emphasize just how untrustworthy these industries are. And, you know, when it comes to food for our animals as well, our pets, why is it that they'd have the pets that we love? Why would their best interests be in the mind of these companies? They're not in the mind of these companies for us. So why would we believe what they're saying about the food for our pets? This is an example of that. Several million unwanted dogs and cats are killed in US animal shelters annually. So this is what we're discussing. Their bodies are rendered into this meat meal. Now, it was reported in the San Francisco Chronicle that both the National Renderers Association, whatever that is, who wants to be part of the National Renderers Association? That sounds like the worst membership place ever. Oh, where are you from? I'm from the National Renderers Association. I mean, goodness, like, the fact that these things even exist is quite startling. Anyway, sorry, I digress. As reported in the San Francisco Chronicle, both the National Renderers Association and the executives at one plant, Modesto Tallow, denied they even used pets. Yet employees, vendors, and state inspectors said they regularly observed dogs and cats rendered at both the Sacramento and Modesto plants. And the AVMA, which I think is the American Veterinary Medical Association, and the FDA, the Food and Drugs Administration, both confirmed this use of pet carcasses. One employee working at Sacramento rendering said, "Thousands and thousands of pounds of dogs and cats are picked up and brought here every day." A former employee confirmed, "The small animals are a big part of the company. Again, because of expensive labor costs, flea collars containing, you know, dangerous insecticides, because the flea collars were commonly not removed prior to rendering." A 1998 FDA survey also detected the euthanizing solution sodium pentobarbital, which is specifically designed to kill dogs and cats and other animals, and consequently is used for this purpose in animal shelters. So the drug that they give to these animals to euthanize them is of course being put into the meat that we feed our pets. In 43 random selected products of dry dog food, they found sodium pentobarbital, the euthanasia drug, and then that's put in the food that we feed to our pets. These ingredients are rendered together, which involves melting to separate fat soluble from water soluble and solid components, removing most of the water, trying to kill the bacterial contaminants, but it also destroys all the nutrients and enzymes and vitamins. And so this is what I was saying before. So the process destroys the nutrients and the vitamins, which means they have to be supplemented back in, which basically means there's not that much difference between the pet food we feed to dogs that comes from meat and the pet food that we feed to dogs that comes from vegan, plant-based alternatives. It's a product that's supplemented with what the animals need, that boost that they need. But at least on the plant-based side, you don't have all of these things that we've been talking about. You have grains and whatever else that we feed to dogs from a healthy, you know, plant-based range, you know, whatever that might be. It just is quite alarming, isn't it, when we lay it out like that, I suppose, and to think about what that really means. There's a little bit here on associated diseases. This is about dogs and cats. Diseases described in the scientific literature following long-term maintenance of cats and dogs on commercial meat-based diets include kidney, liver, hearts, as well as neurological, visual, neuromuscular, and skin diseases, as well as bleeding disorders, birth defects, immunocompromisation, and infectious diseases. And so they describe some of these down below. In the Journal of the American Veterinary Medical Association, the AVMA, in 1989, colleagues published the results of a retrospective review of serum biochemical data from 501 cats over a three-year period in the late 1980s. 37% suffered from abnormally low potassium levels. Within the group, 48% had elevated cholesterol levels, 47% had elevated blood glucose levels, 46% had high serum urea nitrogen concentrations, which is actually really important because the number one killer of cats is kidney renal failure. 43% had high chlorine levels, and 39% at high serum creatine concentrations. Kidney disease, specifically chronic renal failure, the number one killer. Liver disease, viral or bacterial infections, and neurological or neuromuscular diseases were all statistically significantly associated within these cats, which is just harrowing when you think about it. Again, we're fed this idea, well, you shouldn't feed vegan food to cats. That's wrong. They're obligate carnivores. Now, that argument, you could argue that argument if what we are feeding to cats is what they're supposed to be eating. But the problem with this argument is it presupposes that that is what we're doing, that we're feeding cats what they were supposed to eat. And so therefore to do the opposite would be to go against their natural inclinations. But that's not what's happening here. I mean, you think about cats, let's think about a little domesticated cat, Fluffy the cat, let's say, the most unoriginal name for a cat you could think of, right? Fluffy the cat. And so you get pet food for Fluffy the cat and you go, well, I'm going to get the meat-based diet because cats are obligate carnivores, and so it would be wrong not to do that. And so you go into the supermarket and you buy some cat food, and then you look at what's in the cat food and you go, oh, okay, beef, you know, beef casserole for Fluffy. And you think, well, what's beef? Okay, beef is from a cow. And then you think about Fluffy the cat, you know, little Fluffy, and you think about Fluffy the cat trying to kill a cow. It doesn't quite work, does it? And you think about Fluffy the cat, well, what do cats love? Milk. And fish. That's what we're told, right? You know, you think about cats and you think about what they're being fed. It's always milk and fish, cow's milk and fish from the ocean. Why would a cat ever drink cow's milk? That doesn't make any sense, does it? We drink cow's milk, and that's really weird. And then we make our pets drink cow's milk, and then we perpetuate the idea that cats drinking cow's milk is what they're supposed to do. In what world does that make sense? I mean, it's an absolute stretch to try and justify humans doing it, but then to justify domesticated cats doing it is just even more astounding. With the fish thing, think of tuna. Tuna can be, well, like up to 1,200 pounds, right? They can be huge when you think about tuna in the ocean. So you think about Fluffy the cat. Fluffy the cat's supposed to eat fish. That's what we're told. But you think about Fluffy the cat swimming out into the Atlantic Ocean and catching like a 1,000-pound tuna, or whatever the size of the tuna, any size tuna. Think about Fluffy the cat swimming into the ocean, catching a fish, wrestling and getting the fish, and then bringing them back to land again. Because that's what we're told, isn't it? When was that ever something that domesticated cats were meant to eat? You know, I think realistically, if we want to make the argument that we should be feeding cats meat because it's natural to them, okay, but then you've got to follow that through. And so what does that mean? That means small birds, you know, blackbirds, sparrows. It means mice, rats, so small rodents that might be found. That's what it means, small birds and small mammals. And maybe you can make the argument for chicken. Maybe you could do that. But for the majority of the animals that we feed to our pets, they would never eat those animals to begin with. And again, the point of the matter isn't just about that. The point of the matter is the food that we're feeding to them isn't even those bits that they would eat. It's the ground up insides. It's the ground up rendered fat and bones and organs that the cats would never eat or the dogs would never eat anyway. Well, why is it that we say feeding vegan food to these animals is so wrong and so unnatural? But then what we are doing, we don't question it. And so you could say, well, all right then, Ed, what about if we bought the, you know, we went to a butcher's or we did buy our pets the food that we would consume, you know, the breasts and the loins and steaks and, you know, the rump steaks. And so the bits that aren't all these ground up esophagus and all these bits, well, then you've got a problem because you're buying those products. And then that becomes a really difficult ethical and moral problem, doesn't it? Again, the argument of being natural still doesn't work because if you're buying a piece of rump steak from a cow to feed your cat, that doesn't make sense, or the dog, that doesn't work because they would never eat that normally anyway. So even if we're applying the natural argument, that still doesn't add up. But if you want to apply the whole, well, you know, they're meant to eat meat, and so this is a better way of doing it, and it avoids, you know, the problems that we're talking about. Of course, it still has, you know, all these different issues, antibiotics, and in the fish, you've still got the mercury and the PCBs and the toxins and the dioxins and all these different things that are still going to cause problems. It causes problems for us and they cause problems for them. So you could say, yeah, all right, well, that makes a bit more sense. But then the problem is then you're buying those products and we wouldn't go and buy those products for ourselves. And so why would we buy those products for our pets if we didn't have to and if we didn't need to? And so I guess that becomes the question, doesn't it? Can our pets survive off a plant-based diet? It's not, you know, we've kind of maybe discussed the failings of a meat-based diet from a health perspective, obviously from the ingredient perspective. And so we recognize that there's a whole host of problems that are caused by what we feed to our pets, you know, renal failure and cancers and neurological problems and all these different issues, skin disorders as well. In fact, in the Journal of American Veterinary Medical Association, they examined 13 dogs with skin diseases described as a crusting dermatosis, kind of around the mouth and eyes and pressure points such as the elbows. The disease was similar to that previously been called canine dry pederma, so I guess just a skin condition, but is now known to be a zinc responsive dermatosis. All the dogs have been fed nutritionally inadequate dry dog foods, and the skin diseases of all 13 resolved completely after their diets were changed to one that met nutritional recommendations. And so again, what we're feeding to our pets isn't even meeting their nutritional recommendations anyway. So what do we do about that? I suppose one thing we could do is we could look into the possibility of changing how we feed our pets. Now, I think hopefully in the future, this will become a little bit of a null point with things like lab-grown meat, right? It will become almost like we won't have to worry about it anymore. I mean, hopefully that's what's going to happen. It will happen. I don't think we have to hope. It will happen. Lab-grown meat is going to be on the shelves. And as soon as it's on the shelves, it will be available for pet food. It might even be available for pet food first. Who knows? But it will be available. And so that's a great thing for us to, you know, be optimistic for in the future, of course. But for now, we're still faced with that problem. So we've got three options as I see it. The first option is to feed our animals the conventional pet food. The conventional pet food, of course, is something that we don't want to feed them, but it's also a byproduct. And so we don't have to worry as much about perpetuating the industry. The second thing we can do, therefore, is say, well, actually, I don't feel comfortable feeding my pets the food from commercial pet food. It's obviously horrendous. So the second thing that I'll do is I'll buy them meat that I would eat, because that way I don't have to worry in the same way, although I recognize that it might not be ideal, but actually because of, you know, them being omnivores and obligate carnivores like cats are, then I don't have to worry so much, because actually the main bulk of the problem isn't necessarily the fact that they're animal products, it's what type of product they are and how they're processed, blah, blah, blah. And so if I get them the less processed cuts of meat that I would consume, then that's less of a worry, right? But then you've got that moral problem, the moral problem of perpetuating the industry and directly funding more of that industry to continue, which is why we don't want to buy those products, right? So then you have the third option. The third option is exploring plant-based diets for your pets. Now, as I said, you know, I can't tell you what to do. I know people who have healthy dogs on plant-based diets, and I know people who have healthy cats on a plant-based diet. But at the same time, those animals are your responsibility, and so you have to look after them. And so that becomes really tricky, doesn't it? I think for dogs, it's a lot more clear cut. And I think it's a lot easier. I think with cats, it's a bit trickier. But fundamentally, if you boil it down, what we feed to our pets, like I said before, is a product that's supplemented with the amino acids they need, with the vitamins they need, with the minerals that they need. It's supplemented with that anyway. And so vegan food, in essence, is the same thing. It's a product that's supplemented with those additional extras that our pets need. Now, I think it's always very important to be very careful, do some research, look into all of this yourself, you know, take it step by step. Don't do it, you know, an overnight swapping of food. Incorporate it gradually, see how they're getting on, keep monitoring them, keep looking after them, all of these different things you would do anyway as a responsible companion human, and take those steps incrementally. Some cats are fussy eaters, they're not going to take to it, you know. I guess that's the reality of the situation. And then it becomes that question of, are you less vegan? Fundamentally, as an individual, no, you're not less vegan if you have the responsibility to look after a companion animal. And so you yourself, you do your thing, and then of course, as that companion human, make those changes where you can. Obviously be very careful and be mindful. But I do think it's a really important thing to talk about. And I think the problem that people, when they message me, is they worry that they're not vegan. They don't feel genuine referring to themselves as vegan when they have a cat who's eating meat. And I want to stress that doesn't change you and your veganism. You know, you're still vegan and you shouldn't, you know, be questioning yourself. But at the same time, it is definitely important to explore alternatives, you know, and have a look and see what you think. And it's not clear cut. And what I like about this website, and again, I'm just going to say it, Veggie Pets, V-E-G-E Pets. I don't know who's made the website. I'm not sure, but it's been quite a useful resource for me to read through. And what's good about it is it tells both sides and it says, you know, be careful of this and be careful of that. And so I think it's quite a good website just to look through and then come to your own conclusions based on that. And of course, the other issue is the financial issue of vegan pet food. You know, it can be more expensive, of course, because it's not the four Ds, right? Disease, disabled, dying. We're feeding a different product. So of course, it's going to be more expensive at the moment, especially when it's not as commercially viable. And, you know, the supply and demand isn't in place yet. But I do hope this is just a short-term concern. And in the future, we will just have lab-grown meat to overtake that. Let's widen the conversation a little bit now, and I want to talk just more broadly about the considerations around pets in general, and whether or not they are something that we will have in the future. I mean, how do we navigate this ethical conundrum? We believe in the philosophy adopt, don't shop for many reasons, of course. You know, breeders, whether they're puppy mills or more independent, it doesn't really make a difference, does it? You know, it's commodification, it's exploitation. Yes, of course, there's degrees of exploitation and suffering that varies within the different facilities. But ultimately, what it boils down to is that we have millions of animals who are put down every single year because people neglect them, people don't want to look after them anymore, or they're being bred by breeders, and they're just being put in into these shelters. And then they euthanize them, as we've discussed, sometimes turn into dog and cat food anyway. Just horrendous, right? But we have a huge problem. And so while we have an issue where animals are being put down, of course it's wrong and immoral and irresponsible for breeders to be breeding more of these animals into existence just so they can sell them. And breeders follow trends, don't they? So different dogs become trendy at different times. Apparently when Game of Thrones was on, huskies became trendy. And so breeders started breeding more huskies and all of these different things. And so that's exploitation, that's commodification. They're not looking out for the animal's best interest. They're looking out for their financial interests. They want to make money from the commodification of these animals. So adopt, don't shop. It's so important. But here's the kind of crux to that idea. If we stop breeding animals into existence and we're only adopting them, then that means that in the future, there will be a point where we no longer have animals that need rescuing. No more animals are being bred, so no more animals need to be rehomed. No more animals being put in shelters because, you know, that chain is changing and we're rescuing animals instead. So I don't know when that will happen, because of course we're nowhere near that yet. I was looking at different data that's showing how over the years, how many, you know, pets coming from commercial breeders versus rescuing, and actually it's not really changed in in the past decades, which is quite worrying and very troubling. Again, this is the idea of, you know, we call ourselves dog and cat lovers, but do we actually live by that? Just because we put them in our home doesn't mean we actually live by that, because we're still going to breeders and buying them, or puppy mills and buying them. There was a story in the UK recently, I think some reality TV contestants bought a puppy from Russia, and then the puppy died like after a few days of them having the puppy. And then you go, oh, well, did they buy the puppy because they love dogs? No. So that's not a mutually beneficial relationship. It's not a symbiotic relationship. It's a one-sided relationship. Oh, I want a puppy. That puppy looks cute. I'll buy that puppy. Well, okay, well, what about the consideration for these animals, and how when you buy this puppy from Russia or from a puppy mill or wherever it is, from an unlicensed breeder or a licensed breeder, it doesn't make a difference. When you buy these animals, you're facilitating the demand for more of them to be brought into existence. So now they bought that puppy from Russia. Another puppy's been, you know, bred into Russia, who will die as well. And he probably has a whole host of health problems because of the way that we're treating these animals. And so again, we call ourselves a nation of dogs and cat lovers, and we're disgusted by what happens when people kill dogs to eat them. But do we actually live by that? The morals of saying that we actually care about these animals? Do we? I don't think a lot of us do, even people that have these animals in their homes. What was the incentive for having them? Now, when you're rescuing a dog, yes, you can have that selfish intention of, I want to have a dog, they're lovely. But you're doing so with the idea, I'm going to give a dog a home and we're going to have a symbiotic relationship. We'll be companions. We will look after each other. We'll be there for each other. That's the point. That idea of ownership, I think, muddies our relationship with companion animals and facilitates this idea that they are commodities for us to purchase and commodities for us to have in our homes, like an accessory in our life, like a gadget that we buy from Amazon. But rather than being an inanimate object that we find joy in, they're a living sentient being who we find joy in. But we haven't made that differentiation. Yes, of course we have, but at the same time, we still view in ownership. Oh, that's mine. That's mine. I own this. I own that. I own them. And I think that's a really big problem that we need to get around. But in the future, if we're adopting animals and no longer purchasing them and they're no longer being bred, well, then what does that mean for pets? Because will we have pets anymore? Well, presumably no. But then should we have pets? Here's a worrying thought, if we call it that. You know, have you heard of Stockholm Syndrome? It's like a psychological disorder, you know, when people are kidnapped and they become reliant on their captor for food and for shelter and for housing and for warmth, you know, for the necessities for survival. When you rely on someone for that, over time, you begin to love them, right? Not because it's not a genuine thing, it's a psychological thing. It's an unconscious thing that your brain does. Because you're reliant on them, you start to have emotional connection with them, you start to admire them, you start to like them, you start to love them, because you are reliant on them, dependent on them. Every aspect of your life is wholly reliant on that individual or on that person or that group. Stockholm Syndrome. Someone said, well, how do we know that's not what it's like with pets, right? With dogs, for example, we feed them, we take them to the toilet, we take them for walks, they go to bed when we go to bed. Like every single part of their life is dictated to them by us. You know, if they need the toilet, they have to hold it in until they're allowed to go. If they're hungry, it doesn't matter. They have to wait till they get fed. Or they want to go for a walk, they can only go for a walk when we take them for a walk. So we deny, you know, we deny them. And it's not that we deny them, it's because it's different, but they're not autonomous, are they? And so it's no wonder they become so excited when they see us, or so excited when, you know, when we're around, because they're reliant on us for the things that they need in their life. Food and water and exercise and love and connection and compassion. All of these things they're wholly reliant on us for. I mean, I don't think it's as simple as that. You know, I really don't. I think there is absolutely, you know, mutual love there. And I don't think it's as simple as saying it's just a Stockholm syndrome, but it is an interesting concept, isn't it? Let's round up the podcast and then let's finish the podcast. Definitely do your own research if you're a companion human. Look into it. Make sure that whatever you decide to do, you're fully comfortable with. Make sure you know and you've looked at it all and you come to a conclusion that you think is, you know, that is based on the evidence. And then make those, you know, changes. If you want to feed your dog with vegan dog food, then slowly incorporate that. If you want to try your cat on vegan cat food, slowly incorporate that. Make those steps and maybe reach out. I'm sure there's some Facebook groups for vegan dog owners and vegan cat owners. I'm sure they exist on Reddit or Facebook or wherever. So maybe reach out and see how people are doing on those. I know sanctuaries who have dogs and who have cats that are fed vegan. So look for that support and look for that advice and look to see what people can offer and then see how it fits into your life and the decisions that you ultimately have to make yourself. And of course, no one can make those decisions for you. And so that's why it's always really good to look into it yourself. Question, you know, the authenticity of the reasons that we feed the animals what we do now. I mean, is it right to do it? Is it morally justifiable to do it? Is it healthy to do it? Are there problems there? I mean, of course there are. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening to this week's podcast. I hope that you've enjoyed it. And if you have enjoyed it, then please do leave a review actually on iTunes if you're able to and you'd like to. I really appreciate when people leave reviews. It's great to read your feedback and it helps boost the podcast in on iTunes. So if you have to leave a review, that'd be wonderful. But ultimately, I just hope you've enjoyed the episode. And if it's your first time listening, I hope that you'll enjoy the backlog of content in the past. And if you are a regular listener, then thank you for listening up until this point and hopefully into the future as well. If you would like more podcasts, I do a monthly Patreon Q&A podcast, which is just like this, but answering questions that my patrons have. But until we speak next time on the next podcast, hope that you look after yourselves. Please stay safe. Have a wonderful rest of your day wherever you are. Have a wonderful rest of your week. And I look forward to speaking to you in the next podcast.